Welcome, everyone. Nothing like bright and early on a Friday morning to talk all things Mormon, right? Welcome. This is session 215, the history of transparency and censorship within the LDS Church. Congratulations on surviving your first full day of Sunstone, and happy Friday. Before we begin, we ask you to silence your cell phones and be respectful and attentive. The mission of Sunstone is to host a thoughtful and respectful dialogue, and please keep in mind that when you engage in any way, to be respectful of the different types of people here. This session is being recorded and will be available for purchase after. This is a 60-minute session, so it's a little bit quicker. And so because of that, we'll dive right into it. If you were at the session yesterday for Mormon Leaks, it was a great session, so I'm sure this one will be as well. About this session, since the days of Nauvoo, the LDS Church has a long history of secret keeping and censorship. Though there have been times when its leaders' fledgling efforts to increase transparency have been commendable. Join the Mormon Leaks team as they explore the history of transparency, the external promotion thereof, and censorship within the LDS Church. So we have Ryan McKnight. He's the founder of Mormon Leaks and the executive director of the Truth and Transparency Foundation. He has a master's degree in accounting from UNLV and is a former agent with the Nevada Gaming Control Board. Ethan Dodge, also known as Privacy P. Pratt, identifies as a secular Mormon, passionate about truth, a cybersecurity engineer by trade. He oversees all technical operations of Mormon Leaks and has worked with Ryan since nearly the beginning. He believes strongly that a greater empathy and understanding can be achieved through listening to and sharing lived experiences. So thank you for coming. Depending on time, we will have a Q&A at the end, but that we'll see how that goes, because we're ending at 10. So give a warm welcome to Ryan and Ethan.
All right. So Drew kind of alluded to it. You know, this can be a little bit different format for those that were... Is my voice getting picked up here? Or you might be able to still hear me in the back. I don't know. But the format's going to be a little bit different from yesterday, where it was more of an open question. We're actually going to give you guys a presentation today. And so... I think that there is a chance that there will be no Q&A. So, but if there is questions, you guys want to come pull at us out in the hall. You know, we're here the rest of the day today and tomorrow, so don't be afraid to come up and ask us questions. Now, when we submitted this presentation to Sunstone several months ago, we kind of had this vision of what it is that we were going to present, and we're still sort of in that same world, but we have tweaked it a little bit. We are going to talk a little bit about the history of transparency in the LDS Church, but probably not as in-depth as we were initially planning on, because we're also going to talk about what we envision or what we would like the church to be at some point when it comes to transparency. Now, if any of you happen to be in Phoenix Sunstone or at a talk that I gave in St. George last year, when I get up and talk, it is going to be somewhat similar, very close to what I talked there. So I apologize if you were at one of those meetings. Ethan will have a lot of original content, but and I throw in a few things that I didn't say in those ones, I think, too. So just a fair warning, if you were in Phoenix, I apologize. Hopefully most of you weren't. So I'm just going to get right into this. Again, I'm not going to spend too much time on us, but if you were here yesterday, you know, I was born and raised LDS. I served my mission in Spain, the Barcelona mission. I left the church in 2013. I was 32 at the time. I'd gone 32 years of my life without knowing that there was even a reason to not believe in the church. I was completely unaware of any controversial historical things or anything like that. I guess I was naive, I guess. don't want to say that, but I guess it was. The majority of my professional career has been spent as a regulatory auditor for the state of Nevada. I was with the Nevada Gaming Control Board for a long time, and before that I was with the Department of Taxation. So I was the guy that you didn't want knocking on your door. And Ethan also was born and raised in the church. He served his mission in Guatemala. He left in 2016. He was a lot younger than I was when he left the church. He's a baby compared to me. And yeah, he works in the cybersecurity field, which makes him sort of a perfect fit for Mormon Leaks because he's the one that makes sure that all of our sources are able to remain anonymous. That's his job. And he was working under a pseudonym initially because he had, you know, a close family member that worked for the church and who had nothing to do with Mormon Leaks, and he was just trying to sort of respect that person's privacy or whatever. And so he went under the name of Privacy P. Pratt. And then he came out, when was it? Last September, he kind of finally came out. And he's really into craft beer, and he's a beer snob. That's true. So he's going to start off, and let me just go ahead and, again, for those that weren't here yesterday, we are a nonprofit media organization. Okay, we were founded on the belief that increased transparency within the Mormon Church results in fewer untruths and less corruption. Okay, that's what we're sort of founded on. We have three main, you know, pillars, if you will, of where we want the church to be more transparent. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that when it's my turn. But Ethan is going to talk to us. He's going to talk about some instances in church history where, you know, maybe the church tried to suppress information, and maybe some instances in the church where they've tried to be transparent. He's going to go a little bit over that. So I'll turn it over to him.
Awesome. Thank you, everyone, for coming out. As Ryan said, I wanted to go a lot more in depth with this talk. I underestimated how busy I was going to be over the past couple months, but that's okay. This is a topic that I'm super passionate about, as I think comes out in my work in Mormon Leaks. I also love history. I'm no historian by any means. I'm not making that claim. However, I have been toying with the idea of writing a book on this very topic. I'm not going to publicly commit to doing so right now, but I don't know if I'm going to have the time, but I would absolutely love to. If anyone wants to partner with me, that'd be awesome. Maybe an actual historian. Right? So anyway, let's start with the first instance of censorship in church history that I think most of us, the first large instance anyway, that I think most of us are very familiar with, the destruction of the Nauvoo Expositor. For those not familiar with the story, in 1844, the Nauvoo Expositor, they published their first and only issue, and they published information that was accurate, however, also slightly exaggerated about Joseph Smith and his polygamy, because Joseph Smith he tried very hard to keep his polygamous practices under wraps, even hiding them from his wife Emma, and even to the extent where when he was publicly confronted about them by women who he had asked to marry, he would publicly shame them right then and there, and it was a disaster, right? William Law and a handful of other people, as I said, I'm not a historian, but I believe he was a member of the Quorum of the Twelve before he actually left First Presidency. Thank you. Him and a couple others spun up the Nauvoo Expositor, published an issue talking about Joseph Smith's polygamy. And then a few days later, Joseph Smith, he was really upset, and he ordered the destruction of the printing press of the Nauvoo Expositor. The Nauvoo Expositor never published again. Stacked all the entire printing press right there in the street and then lit it on fire. I actually had the opportunity to go to Nauvoo this summer. And I found what I was told by a tour guide from the Community of Christ, what was the building that the Nauvoo Expositor was in. It's a furniture store now, which I thought was a little unfortunate because I think it's a very important part of Mormon history. The mentality of censorship and infallible leaders really dates back to Joseph Smith, and as I said, he kept the polygamy very much under wraps, and whether or not that was for whether or not you believe that that was because he was directed by God to do so, or because he was embarrassed by it, or what have you, the fact remains that that is still censorship, right? So that and there's so, as I said, there's so many topics that we could hit in the history of the church in terms of transparency, transparency and censorship, including Brigham Young. Brigham Young was also a master of censorship, if you will. as I said, I'm not able to go into as much depth as I would like. But let's hit a topic that that I think many of us, at least me, am personally very much interested in, and that's financial reports. The church actually used to publish financial data every year up until 1959. And they actually used to, if a tithe-paying member wanted to see the books, they, or so a quote by Joseph F. Smith claims, which we'll see in the next slide, they could go to the church office building, and or whatever the offices were back then, and ask to see the books, and they would be shown them. That is definitely not the case anymore, right? In fact, the very opposite. But they would publish financial data up until 1959, and that data included things like how much tithing was paid and what percentage of the membership was paying their tithing. If they were to do this today, that'd be awesome. In fact, half of our job would would go away, right? As Mormon leaks. Here's the quote that I was talking about. For those of you not familiar with these style of memes, definitely check out mistandsunday.com by Craig Stapley. He does some amazing work. On the far side over there is the quote from Joseph F. Smith, in which he says, if he wants to be more searching as a tithe payer and find out what is done with the tithing, we will set before him the whole thing, and he has any good if he has any good counsel to give us, we will take it from him. So Joseph F. Smith said that in the April conference in 1906. And over here is a quote from Michael Quinn that he published, that was taken from an essay, LDS Church Finances from the 1830s to 1990s, which I believe was published in Sunstone Magazine. And he said, by the end of 1959, the church had spent more than $8 million more than that year's income. This deficit was extraordinary in view of the fact that the church had a surplus income of $7 million after its 1958 expenditures. To conceal the massive increase of building expenditures in the last half of 1959, which created that deficit, the church stopped releasing even abbreviated financial reports. And as we know, they have not provided detailed financial reports since. The statistical report in which they report every April, actually, if I'm not mistaken, this past April, they didn't even report it in general conference. They did put it on the LDS.org website, but they actually did not report it in general conference. It doesn't include any financial information. It includes membership information, number of missionaries, number of baptisms, stuff like that, right? Here's an example. This was actually put together by D. Michael Quinn in his recent book, The Mormon Hierarchy, Wealth and Corporate Power. And as you see, he actually lists out here in 1943, $15 million of tithing came in, which in 43, that was an insane amount of money. It'd be very interesting to plug that into an inflation calculator and see how much money that is in 2018. And then you'll see the amount of expenditures that the church had that year as well. And then also you see this percent increase. So this was the type of data that they were publishing back then. How many of you would love to see that type of data today in 2018? I think most of us in this room would, right? Especially the tithe-paying members in here. I'm no longer a tithe-paying member, but still be very curious to see. Here's another instance in which they kind of drilled down into what, this is from the 20s, and what they drilled down exactly where those expenditures are going. You'll see in 1924, $120,000 to general authorities. I'm sure that was covered things like their salary or their modest living stipend, whatever you want to call it, and travel expenses, whatever they had back then, right? Again, I would be fascinated to see what these numbers came out to be today in 2018. This is also from D. Michael Quinn's book, which I highly recommend. He has a whole chapter specifically about these financial reports and how and what they included and whatnot. Let's move on to Leonard Arrington. How many of you were in the panel yesterday about Leonard Arrington? It was fantastic, absolutely fantastic. So I am a big fan of Leonard. I think he's a badass, and I wish he was still around today. I do think his legacy lives on in a lot of people, but he's kind of been called the father of new Mormon history, for those of you who aren't familiar with him. He was the first and only, I should have added that, professional historian as church historian. It was interesting because up until he was called as church historian, it was always a general authority. I believe it was Joseph Fielding Smith who was the church historian before him. And then it was supposed to be Howard W. Hunter, but then they decided to expand the church history department and hire a professional historian to be the church historian, and they hired Leonard Arrington, and they regretted hiring a professional historian, and hence he was the only one. I actually verified this information with several historians because I was a bit skeptical at the claim that he was the only one. But that is true. If you look at Elder Snow, the current church historian, he has a JD. He's an attorney, not necessarily a historian. He advocated for a much more open and honest telling of Mormon history, as was said in the panel yesterday. Helen Mar Kimball would not have been several months shy of 15. She would have been 14 years old in that essay, right? Leonard Arrington was kind of a no bullshit kind of guy, right? Just cut to the point. He sanctioned and oversaw the writing of a book called The Story of the Latter-day Saints. He spoke it in which that book, he did not write the book, however, he oversaw the writing, editing, and publication of it. And one of the biggest things that book got criticized for was it mentioned Brigham Young's tobacco use, right? And many members of the 12, specifically Marky Peterson, were not happy with the fact that they portrayed Brigham Young in that sense, that he was a tobacco chewer. And Leonard Arrington was like, it's a biography, like, well, this wasn't a particularly biography of Brigham Young, but we're historians, we report the facts, warts and all. That's what Leonard Arrington was famous for saying, warts and all. He strongly opposed the correlation program, to the extent that they wanted to send all of his work as church historian and through all the work that came out of the church history department through the correlation program. For those of you not familiar with what the correlation program is, it is the program that decides what is put in the Sunday school manuals for the LDS church. And they make sure that everything is consistent across all manuals, across Young Women, Elders Quorum, Relief Society, right? And they literally pick and choose what to put in, right? They choose what ellipses to put in, what quotes to give you certain bias on the quote and whatnot. I really enjoy this quote from Leonard in saying, "I do not think we could determine the truth of what had happened in history by having the Quorum of the 12 vote on it." I love that quote, right? Because that is literally what they were doing with the correlation program. So they wanted to push all of their work through the correlation program. He strongly opposed that. So instead, him and a handful of others would read and edit themselves. And because of that, there was a growing tension between him and the Quorum of the 12, because they were sharing things that the Quorum of the 12 would rather, that they didn't see favorable, and it led to his dismissal as church historian. He dreamed of a comprehensive series of church history, but it never happened. And correct me if I'm I want to say this was like a series of like 20 books that he dreamed of, right? 16. Thank you. 16 volumes. It never happened, but it did. And several of the authors that were supposed to participate in it, did go on to publish their work, and actually Rough Stone Rolling by Richard Bushman the original work that that eventually became Rough Stone Rolling, was part of this comprehensive church history, as was Early Mormonism and the Magic Worldview by D. Michael Quinn. So his dream kind of lived on in that sense, but it was never this series. The Deseret book was actually supposed to publish these series, but for those of you who have read Rough Stone Rolling and Early Mormonism and the Magic Worldview, we all know that it has many things that, I guess, I apologize. Who actually published Rough Stone Rolling? Okay, thank you. I remember it came out on the 200th anniversary of Joseph Smith's birth. But anyway, those are remnants of today of Leonard Arrington's work that we have. The church ended up moving the history department to BYU to kind of disassociate it with headquarters, because they kind of thought that they could have a church history department but still keep, like, distance themselves from official church correlation material and still have it up in Salt Lake City, but that was not the case. So they ended up moving it to BYU, and they released Leonard Arrington as church historian. And he, there was a book that about Brigham Young, I believe it's called Brigham Young and American Moses or something like that. And that he was never able to publish as he was church historian, but he was able to go on and publish later. I actually just found this out this morning from Christina Rossetti that I thought was very interesting. His picture that was never on display with all the other church historians until 4 years after his death. During his tenure, his picture was not on display, and apparently they had his assistant's picture up there. And then it wasn't until he died in 1999, it wasn't until 2003 that his picture was added to the wall that showed all the church historians, which I thought was very, very interesting. Any questions or comments on Leonard Arrington? Nope. All right. Let's jump to today in 2018. There have been some interesting efforts. Yesterday there was an interesting question about Leonard Arrington in the panel, and the person asked if the panel thought that without Leonard Arrington, without his work, if the church would be making its effort in towards transparency, such as the church essays and other things that I'm about to talk about, if they would still be moving towards that direction. And historians don't like to speculate, one of them did imply that the internet is kind of really what forced the church's hand in a lot of those things, because a lot of this information before you had to go to an archive, either at BYU or the University of Utah, and find these things, but then the internet, where anyone can publish anything, right, kind of made them address their history that they had previously kept hidden. The first gospel topic essay was published in 2013, in late 2013, in November, I believe, and it was, the first one was, they published two in the same day. The first one was "Are Mormons Christian?" and the other one was, I'm blanking now. Oh yeah, First Vision Accounts. Thank you. And then later, before the end of the year, they had published one on Joseph Smith's polygamy and on race in the priesthood. And then many came out through 2014. And then I believe the most recent one was published in 2015, and that's on Mother in Heaven. It's an attempt to address controversial issues with church history. I think it's fairly commendable. But as I said, if Leonard Arrington were in charge today, a lot of the wording would be different in those essays, such as several months shy of 15 years old. Joseph Smith Papers, a phenomenal project that started in 2008. I'm sure many of you here are familiar with it, in which they are attempting to publish all documentation created by or under the direction of Joseph Smith. Some amazing things have already come out of the Joseph Smith Papers Project. I believe this is one of the most valiant efforts from the LDS Church. And it's not just the LDS Church, it's in conjunction with many other organizations, but under the direction of the LDS Church. And however, despite both of these, I personally do not think it's enough. And not only that, there have been recent instances that we are directly related with, such in March 2017, we published a bubble chart or an enemies list of the church that was leaked to us, and the church the very next day issued us a DMCA takedown request saying that we were infringing on their copyright and thus using copyright law as a form of censorship. Our attorney wrote back to them and said that that is a misuse of copyright and that we are completely covered under the fair use doctrine. So the church is still attempting to silence some through DMCA. With Sandra Tanner's in the room, and she has a lot of experience with things like this as well. She was one of the early. Her and her husband did a lot of work towards transparency within the church as well, and actually they've served as part of my inspiration for our work in Mormon Leaks. Yeah, that's just a super quick overview of censorship and transparency today, from the beginning to today. Again, I'd love to talk to more people about this in depth, and I hope to continue my research, maybe I'll blog about it. Like I said, maybe I'll write a book. I don't know. We'll see. I'll keep you all updated.
All right, so we're going to kind of move on to the second half of this topic. You know, which is going to be, you know, how does Mormon Leaks play into all of this, right? And first, the basis for our push for transparency, it's an ethical proposition, right? So we're talking about the ethics of transparency. And the reason why I like to point out that we're talking about ethics here is because, as most of you probably know, there is no legal obligation for the church to be transparent. The legal obligations that other nonprofit organizations have, that we see, you know, other charities, religion has been carved out of those laws. So religion is the last sacred cow, as many would say, here in this country. So, you know, it's an ethical proposition with the church. And, you know, what is ethics? It's a conceptual framework of business ethics and organizational management, which address moral and ethical values in the management of a business or other organization. Now, that's not meant to be necessarily a definition of ethics, but when we're talking about ethics in the context of an organization like the church, this is what we're talking about, okay? So one of the things that I like to discuss in these presentations is, we get a lot of people that don't like us that will send us messages or comment on our stuff, something along the lines of, well, if the church doesn't need to be transparent, and if you don't like it, don't pay them money, right? Something along these lines. And the implication is that transparency isn't as important to believing Mormons or anybody really as we think it is, right? And that's, I would argue, is not really true. And even if a believing Mormon says that transparency isn't important to them, I would argue that maybe they just don't realize how important it actually is to them. And so there's several aspects in our lives outside of the church, outside of religion, where not only do we have transparency and maybe don't realize it, but we would be upset if we didn't have it. So I just want to give a couple quick examples. So if we look at the world of retail sales, now I'm going to be talking about business stuff here because the church is a form of a business, okay? It's a business that dabbles in religion. Although they would probably have you believe the other way around, right? A religion that dabbles in business. I say it's a business that dabbles in religion. So, but if we look at the world of retail sales, right? You go to the store, you go to Walmart, and you buy, something. You buy a hamburger helper box, right? And what do they disclose to you? The ingredients, right? This is a form of transparency that sometimes we don't even realize. Okay, what if they did? What if you went to the store and you didn't know what the ingredients were on a food? You might have allergy issues and all this stuff. I don't know. We all get the picture on that, right? In some cases, products that are sold at retail, you know, might have a country of origin listed. Okay, possibly. Expiration dates, right? Anybody here want to go buy, you know, some yogurt without knowing the expiration date? I don't think so. If they stopped publishing, now I don't know. I have no idea if they're required by law to publish the expiration date or not. I don't know if that's compelled or if they just do that because they know it's for the greater good. But if they stopped publishing expiration dates on yogurt, I think people would be upset about that, right? Health information, you know, calories, all this kind of, this is all transparency that we just take for granted in our everyday lives. And we all benefit from it. Now, do we all go and buy something and study all of this on the back of a label? We might not. But it's there if we want it. Return policies, right? This is important. Especially with high-end items, usually return policies are very spelled out. Again, I don't know what the laws are, but just imagine going to Best Buy, for example. Buying a computer, you know, you spend $2,000 on like a real fancy computer, and you go to the register, and the guy at the register says, you have 14 days to return it. Okay, so you go home. There's something wrong with it that you don't really like. You come back 7 days later, and you get brought to a manager there that you hadn't dealt with before, and the manager says, oh, no, it's a three-day policy. Well, the guy last week said it was 14. Well, I don't know. He told you the wrong thing. Well, what does Best Buy do? It's when they do whatever their policy is, it's printed on the receipt somewhere. There's going to be a sign somewhere, maybe both. So there's some information there. And what does that information do? Aside from informing you of the return policy, it protects you from a manager who may not want this return to affect his numbers at the end of the month. And he can't just come and sort of make something up on the spot. So that transparency Best Buy or whatever store engages in, it protects you as a consumer. And again, you might not care about it, but the day you do care about it, it's there. All right, let's look at like the service industry. Lawyers. We got any lawyers in here? You want to admit it? No, I'm not going to do any lawyer jokes. I like lawyers. But, you know, lawyers, when you go to a lawyer, typically, when they send you their bill, there's going to be a breakdown of what they did. Now, we know lawyers are expensive. They're overpriced, right? They get paid way much more than they're worth. No, I'm just kidding. But they do cost a lot of money typically, right? And so if you're going to shell out several thousand dollars, it would kind of be nice to know a little bit about what they did. I mean, imagine if a lawyer just said, oh, that was, you know, I took care of everything, $5,000, have a nice day. I don't think most of us would be happy. Now, again, I don't know what the law compels lawyers to do when it comes to this, but whether it's they're compelled legally or they just do it because they know it's the right thing to do, you will get a bill from a lawyer that is somewhat detailed. And I don't know, what is the typical increment of time that lawyers will put on their bills?
6 minutes.
Oh, wow. I did not know it was that. Is that standard?
Standard.
Okay. Well, there you go. I mean, that's pretty good. You know, and so you can sit there and look and see what they did, right? And
unless you negotiate for a flat fee, which is a different story.
Sure. There's exceptions to all of it. Right.
They're notorious for padding their hours.
Right. Took me 6 minutes to write an email that was two sentences long. No, I'm kidding. Okay, so accountants are similar to lawyers. You know, they might not be quite as expensive, but they will often disclose in a similar way their work to their clients, especially if it's high-dollar clients. They will do breakouts. I don't know that accountants do six-minute breakouts, but they will break out and give, you know, what it is they do. Contractors, similar. You know, you hire some company to remodel your kitchen, and they're going to give you fairly detailed invoices, okay? And then on top of all of that, if you feel like your attorney or your accountant or your contractor has been dishonest about something, has wronged you in some way, you have the ability to appeal. You know, again, I don't want to get into all the different scenarios, but you guys get my point. There's typically governing bodies that are associated to all of these professions, to where you can take a grievance and air that grievance. Okay, so there is a way to hold the people that are performing these services accountable to a certain extent. And of course, that doesn't mean that, you know, that justice is perfect in these situations. But all right, now let's shift over and talk about public companies, publicly traded companies that you could buy stock in. Okay, as you may know, that they are required by law to publish their financials on a yearly basis. And you can go to any publicly traded company to their website, and somewhere at the bottom, typically, there'll be something that'll say financials, or, you know, it'll be labeled in some way like that. And you'll be able to download their most recent set of financials that they published. And you'll be able to see, you know, these are typically very long documents. You know, they're good for if you're having trouble to sleep at night, okay? But sometimes they're fascinating. I've done a lot of research and reading into these for, you know, things that I've had to do for work. But some of the typical things that you'll see in there is you'll typically see the salaries of the top executives, okay? You'll see the financials, which when you say the financials, typically you're talking about a balance sheet, okay? Income statement, cash flow, things like this. And accompanying that will be typically footnotes, which will outline extraordinary events that may have occurred that year or things that are highly likely to occur in the coming months of the next year. Okay? So I'll give you an example. Let's say that there's a publicly traded company and they had a phenomenal year. 2017 was amazing. And because of that, they actually have $100 million cash in the bank, okay? And that's reported on their balance sheet. And let's just assume that for whatever industry this company is, that's a ton of money, okay? And so maybe, you know, investors who are considering purchasing stock in this company would look at that, and maybe they hear the rhetoric of the executives, and they're thinking, wow, you know, they've got all this money for expansion. You know, we're only going up from here. I want to buy this stock. But it turns out that the executives are aware of this lawsuit that's been going on for years. And it's finally coming to a head here. We're talking 2017. And as they're preparing the 2017 financials in early 2018, the attorneys alert the executives that, hey, you know, we're at the end of this lawsuit and we're probably going to have to, you know, within the next month or so, we're going to have to shell out because we did something wrong or whatever. We're going to have to shell out $50 million in this lawsuit. And so not only has it not happened yet, it's not 100% guaranteed. The lawyers have said it's most likely going to happen, and it's going to happen in a couple of months. So would they be honest in publishing those 2017 financials showing $100 million in the bank and leaving it at that and letting their investors assume they've got they're flush with cash for expansion? The answer is no, and they are required by law to disclose the fact that they have an impending settlement that's going to cost them $50 million. Okay, so now there are some guidelines on that as far as when they have to disclose it and when they don't. There are circumstances where they don't. But generally speaking, if there's a large settlement like that that's imminent, even though it's in the next year, they're going to disclose it. Because what is that? That's in the best interest of the shareholders. All right. Let's get to what we all want to talk about. How does all this mess apply to the LDS Church? Okay. The tithe payers, like I said before, the church is a business that dabbles in religion. If you don't agree with me, I apologize, but that is what it is. Okay. They have much more money tied up in business than they do in religion. The business endeavors of the church are all funded by tax tithing, which is, if you look at the church kind of like a government, right? Tithing is taxes. The taxes are then invested into, you know, their business endeavors and hopefully produce a positive return. Okay. So the tithe payers are what I like to refer to as stakeholders. Now they're not shareholders. Like shareholders, that's you own stock in a company, you're a shareholder. A stakeholder is a much more loose term. And a stakeholder is simply anybody that has any interest in a business, any kind of connection or interest, okay? So you could argue that we are all in here. If you, let's, you know, whatever store you shop at, you know, Walmart, Target, you are a stakeholder at Walmart, because whatever decisions that they make affect you as a consumer of that store. So tithe payers are stakeholders. And the stakeholders have an ethical right to know what is going on. So there's three pillars, three areas where we really focus our where we want to see more transparency. Okay? First being corporate policies and procedures. Translation, instruction manuals. Okay? So there are some manuals and a lot of manuals that are available online through LDS.org, but obviously there's a lot of manuals that we never get to see. So we would say that the church needs to publish all of their manuals that contain corporate policies and procedures. I'll go back to the return policy at Best Buy, where a manager, if you don't have the return policy in writing, could maybe manipulate the situation so that things look better to him for his higher-ups. Actually, when I gave this talk in St. George, I'm blanking on her last name, Nadine Hansen. Thank you. She was there, and she actually, during the question session, got up and actually made a comment about this that was really interesting. She had a personal experience with somebody that she knew that had done something, some sort of sin, and the bishop of this person was telling her, not Nadine, but this friend of hers, that his hands were tied. He didn't want to give her a disciplinary counsel for excommunication, but he had to because the church required it. And Nadine knew that bishop's manual was out on the internet. And so she took that manual to this friend of hers and said, no, look, this is not listed in the list of sins that require a disciplinary counsel. Sure, you could. I mean, a bishop can do a disciplinary counsel for anything he wants. But for him to say his hands are tied, that's just simply not true. And this woman went to her bishop with that information, and apparently he dropped the whole situation. So this is why it's important for people to know what are the policies and procedures are of the organization that they are participating in. It protects them, from rogue agents within the church. Committees. We know the church loves committees. Everybody in here who's ever been an active Mormon has been on a committee. Right? Okay, so they love committees. So just like we have tons of committees at the ward and stake level, they have committees at the corporate level. Do we really know what those committees are, though? I mean, we might know a couple of them. Does anybody here know who is on the correlation committee? You don't count. Yeah, you don't count. You used to work there. They don't, as far as I know, the church does not make public who is on the correlation committee. Now, we actually have something that we haven't released yet just because I've been distracted with other things. We have an old listing. I think it's about 5 or 6 years old of who was on the correlation committee. It's pretty interesting. We'll probably release it at some point. But we should know who we'll get it out there. I've been saying that for like 6 months, and I still haven't got it out there. But we will. The strengthening, what is it called?
Strengthening the church members committee.
Now, didn't Holland say he had no idea what that was about? He gave a little Weasley response to that question on the BBC.
Ben Schaefer has personal experience.
We also have, in the same document that shows the correlation committee, the Strengthening Church Members Committee members is also on that with their pictures. Okay? And guess what? Two of the members are apostles. Now, they're not Holland, but I find it hard to believe that Holland doesn't know what the committee is when two of his close colleagues are on it. And my understanding is they rotate every several years. So the committee members that we have, I believe, if I remember correctly, it was two apostles and like a couple 70, and then maybe like a church employee or something like that. And it was called the Strengthening Church Members Committee. So that exists, and there are members, and Holland knows about it. So we need to know what these committees are, who the members are, and what is their purpose. Okay? Because if we have a grievance to air on the local level, we need to know who to go to. Who's the committee that handles these things, for example? When something comes rolling down the pipe, some new policy, we can maybe know where that policy came from based on the different committees and their purposes. So this is just information that not only gives people power, but helps keep the church a little bit honest too. The corporate structure, the hierarchy of the church, you start the prophet on down, is also important. Organizational chart. Most publicly traded companies also publish an organizational chart. It's not an unreasonable request. All right, let's move to sex abuse statistics. This is another one of our areas where we would like the church to be better. Now, I want to be clear. We're not asking for the church to publish a sex offender registry so you can look up who's the sex offenders in your ward. We're not asking that. We're not asking people to out people necessarily. I mean, obviously, if there's a criminal case, then that would likely get out. But what we think would be reasonable would be an annual report. Let's start with an annual report that the church could publish. Okay, and they could divvy it up by regions, and they could maybe put in there what are the number of allegations of sexual abuse per region. How about the number of those allegations that resulted in criminal charges? The number of those allegations that resulted in monetary settlements? And then the round number of how much in that region. We could also say dollar amount. Also, something I think I forgot to put in the slide. We could do how many of those allegations, one of them is criminal charges, but also how many of those allegations led to civil lawsuits, right? As opposed to just sort of being settled or maybe didn't go anywhere at all, okay? Now, why is all this important? Because information is power. And right now, we can only assume how bad or not as bad as we think it is the problem is. We really don't know. We can only assume. And you could, if they publish these statistics, a member of the church could maybe pull it up, let's say, 5-year trend, okay? And they could see how their region is doing. Is it trending downward? Is it staying the same? Is it going up? And they can decide whether those numbers seem reasonable, because obviously the church cannot prevent every instance of sexual abuse, right? No organization can do that. It's more about how they handle it, really, is what's at stake here. And so let's say that you look at your region 5-year trend and you see sort of an uptick in allegations, or you're seeing an uptick in dollar amount in settlements, which is your tithing dollars. And you can go to your leaders and say, we've had this uptick over the last 5 years. What are we doing to try to mitigate this? Are we doing anything? And then the leaders can say, we've implemented this and that. And then you can say, it appears it's not working. Maybe we need to try something else. Though those conversations can't be had right now. Because right now, if first of all, you don't actually know if there's a big problem in your area. But let's just say you assume there is, and you go to your stake president and you say, I feel like we have a serious problem and we're not doing what we can do. And they'll just say, don't worry, the problem isn't as bad as you think it is. You're listening too much to Mormon leaks in the internet. How are you going to refute that? Okay? So this is why it's important. It puts the power back in the hands of the people. And as far as I'm concerned, the leaders should want this too, because they're always telling us that they're not perfect. Are they not always telling us that? So if they're not perfect, let us help them. Keep them honest. All right. The one we all like. Finances. Okay. What's reasonable to expect the church to do in terms of finances? Because it's not reasonable to say, we want you to publish every line item, every journal entry that's ever made throughout the course of the year. That would be a start. But this church is somewhat unique compared to most Christian churches. But maybe on the local level, they could model it after the typical Christian church. On the local level, why can't there be a quarterly insert into your program that shows how much tithing was brought in for the quarter? How much was spent on the ward budget? How much was spent on welfare? Not a list of the names of the people who received welfare, but we spent $10,000 this quarter on welfare, whatever. Okay, simple. None of this is bad information. Does anybody think this would be reason to criticize the church? We would be, I don't know how many people in here are believers or ex-Mormon or where you are in the spectrum, but I think all of us would applaud the church if they did something like this, publish things on the local level. They can do it also on a regional level. Okay, what are the numbers for regional? And, of course, on the corporate level. I'm referring to it as the corporate level throughout this thing on purpose. Okay, it's not. I refer to the church as a corporation. And I don't think the corporate level or even the regional level would have to be quarterly. That could be annually, because it could be laborious to put these things together. Okay. I think at the corporate level, as opposed to what Jesse said about maybe, you know, look at what other Christian churches do, at the corporate level, I would suggest look at what publicly traded companies do, because the church's operation is much more aligned with those types of companies than any other thing. And if they just had an outside audit done every year and published those findings, we're all happy. Which would require a true third-party audit. Now, I actually am not 100% sure if they do third-party audits right now. They may. But the fact that they don't publish them, you know, it just it kind of makes it almost pointless. Executive salaries, right? This is another thing that we think they need to be, you know, more transparent in. And it's not to shame them, okay, or not to say you make too much money, because personally, I'm not really interested in that debate of whether or not they make too much money or too little money. I don't care how much they make. I don't pay their salary anymore. And you could probably argue that based on the work that they do at like the 70 level and above, that in some cases, maybe even most, they're worth millions of dollars in the private sector. So even if they made millions of dollars, they could probably justify it. And if they made $500,000, if they made only 120 base that we showed a couple years ago, which is they make more than that, but we just don't know how much more because that's the base. It doesn't matter how much they make. The bottom line is that they are receiving their modest stipend, which is in what, the top 1% of the world. I wish I had that modest stipend. From people who are giving charitable donations. And so here's my question to people when debating this. And I'm going to wrap this up here, and we might have time for like one or two questions. But this is what I say, especially to like a believing Mormon who maybe is, you know, suspect of the church's ethical obligation to be transparent. Remove Mormonism from the equation. Remove religion from the equation. If an organization receives its operating budget largely or exclusively from charitable donations, does that organization have an ethical responsibility to be transparent to their donors on how that money is spent? I've never had anybody convince me that the answer to that question is no. And so if we're going to say the answer is yes, then why should the LDS Church or any religion for that matter be exempt from that ethical proposition? Again, we're not talking legal. And, you know, I would argue, and you know, I've never been convinced that otherwise, that it is the right thing to do to publish their financials and these other things we've talked about. And most of us, if not all of us, we were all brought up being taught what? Do the right thing, let the consequences follow. That's how I was brought up, and I believed that my entire life, which is why I left the church, okay? Because I thought the church always did do the right thing. I truly believed that. So anytime somebody says, well, you know, you might, you know, if you put out there exactly how much tithing the church has, it might cause a single mother who's struggling to not pay her tithing. And now that you've placed a stumbling block in front of her eternal progression. Somebody actually told me that. Okay. And I said, you know what? I don't believe that information is a stumbling block. Okay. I don't believe that. So if people are turned off, and maybe it would happen and maybe it wouldn't, if people were turned off by the financials, if they were disclosed, causing them to either not pay tithing or pay less tithing, that is simply a consequence that the church would have to deal with after having done the right thing. So that's my ending message to the church, to their, you know, whoever in here or will listen to the recording later that's taking notes for the church and letting them know what Mormon Leaks said at Sunstone. Please let them know that my message to them is do the right thing and let the consequences follow. And that's it. So we'll do, you know, maybe I think we can do two questions. So make them good. Here comes one. And here comes two. These are our two questions. Everybody else come get us afterwards.
You know, I like what you do, and I think you got a great program going. But I'm kind of wondering, you probably reached the point where your program is kind of expensive to operate. How do you finance your operation?
Oh, we don't disclose our finances. No, I'm kidding. That's none of your business. Of course, you all know that's not true. You can go to our website, and there's a button that says finances. You'll see the finances there. We have our 2017. I mean, we're still new, so we don't have a lot of information there. But you can go and you can look at the 2017 990 that we filed with the IRS, which actually provides quite a bit of detail. And the detail is probably due to the fact that we don't bring in a lot of money. But just as a summary, we've brought in, since inception, we've brought in, I believe, somewhere in the range of $16,000 in donations.
And just to be clear, when he says website, he's talking about our nonprofit website, truthandtransparency.org/finances.
Yeah.
And does that $16,000 also include things that have come in through from faith leaks as well?
Yes, that would be total. So we have, the way we're structured is we have the Truth and Transparency Foundation, which is a 501c3. Donations are tax deductible. And that organization operates Mormon Leaks and another website called Faith Leaks, which hasn't had as much success as Mormon Leaks yet. But so all donations go through the Truth and Transparency Foundation. We've received approximately $16,000. And you can see how we've spent it. It's all in the financial thing. Okay. We don't make any money. We've never had even a $10 stipend. Okay. Now, when we travel, for example, to Utah for an event like this, that money for travel comes out of Mormon Leaks. But we don't make any money for what we do. And even if we wanted to, we don't brought in enough money to make any money. So that money goes to running the website. The servers can be expensive depending on traffic in a particular month. And then just sort of general expenses. Again, you can go on there and see the breakdown of the different expenses.
In your eyes, what would you think would be a significant leak that would make positive change in the LDS Church? And also, do you ever see a time where you'll have several sources that are high-ranking officials?
That are what?
Several sources that are high-ranking church officials.
High-ranking. Yeah, as far as who the source, you know, high-ranking sources, I mean, for all I know, we've already had that. You know, because while I know the identity of some of the sources, I don't know the identity of all of them.
That's the point of our submission system. That's my job, is to make sure that we don't know who our sources are unless they go out of their
way
to
tell
us.
They have to go out of their way to tell us. Okay. The other question that you had, what would have a significant impact on the church? I talked about yesterday, I'm kind of a pessimist on that. I don't really think the church is going to change at all in anything we do. I mean, I suppose we could get something crazy, and I don't know what it would be, but I mean,
most change is going to come from like a grassroots level,
that
like somebody at a ward level starting, or maybe like a bishop publishing his ward's finances. I don't know, right?
That could
just
happen.
An example,
one of the problems preventing that from happening is the church is as they do in many different things is they've got the membership on mental lockdown on this issue. We have members who just assume out of hand that our website is like anti-Mormon. They don't even read our content. And they just, you know, so they're not, you know, there are active members that want more transparency, but there's a very small minority right now. We will occasionally get messages from people, you know, claiming to be active Mormons, and they'll say, you know, something like, you know, I have a testimony, I believe in the church. My one issue is the lack of transparency, so thank you for what you're doing. But we don't get a ton of those messages. My message to believing members, though, is don't be afraid of our website. Don't believe the hype. Don't believe what you read on the internet. Okay? I always knew, like, not to believe what you read on the internet. But once Mormon Leaks started, I really learned how true that is. Okay? So, like, even if you read, like, a news article and they quote me and stuff like that, if something seems a little off, send me a message. Because, you know, not everything... You know, not everything can be fully explained in a two-sentence quote that they lifted from, you know, a 20-minute conversation that I had with them on the phone. So, And, you know, so what was I getting at with that? Oh, yeah, I, my message to active Mormons is don't be afraid of our site. Almost every one of our leaks, with the exception of one or two, can be viewed from a faithful perspective. And I truly believe that. So, and we don't try to influence the way you should view it. So we will do one more question. McKenna wanted to ask a question, and then we'll stop it.
Sorry. So you don't have enough money right now to do Mormon Leaks full time to earn a salary from mm-hmm. that. I have two questions about that. How much do you need? And how much better would Mormon Leaks and Truth and Transparency be if you had the money to do this full time?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely would be a lot better, because we do all everything that we've done that you've seen us do, we've done it in our free time, late at night, you know, in between breaks at work, you know, juggling our kids and stuff. So if we could dedicate 40 to 50 hours a week, both of us, to we have all kinds of things that we want to do that we do think could have an impact and a bigger impact, already, not just on Mormonism, but religion in general. As far as how much do we need, it's a hard question to answer. Probably more than anybody would ever give us. So that's the reality, which is why, and I hate asking for money. I really do. We didn't really overtly ask for money for a long time, and I just got to the point where I couldn't front any more money. I needed to get reimbursed, and so we did like a donation drive last year, and we brought in a, you know, decent amount of that. $16,000 came in because of that. So, I mean, at least right now we're to the point where we're not fronting money anymore, and we're only donating our time, which helps. But yeah, it would be really hard to say how much for us to be able to leave our jobs and do this full time. It'd be hard to say. So, again, thank you guys for coming. If you have any other questions, you know, don't be shy to come up and talk to us.